M&A Madness. Welcome to this audio issue of Porter's Daily Journal, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. The moves and money made between a deal announced and a deal done inside today's issue essay. M&A Madness. Data Center CapEx estimates keep rising after the IPO hoopla settles short interest in the S&P jumps chart of the day. Philip Morris International, PM. Today's mailbag editor's note. Porter turned today's Daily Journal over to distressed investing lead analyst Marty Fridson, who looks at the Paramount Skydance Warner Brothers Discovery merger. The deal was recently halted by a federal judge, leading to another round of share price fluctuations for both companies. Marty views the merger from the perspective of the traders who worked the deal along its long path to success or failure. Here's Marty. If anything moves markets, it's the tortuous path of a big-time merger, as most recently seen with the ongoing attempt by media and entertainment conglomerate Paramount Skydance, PSKY, to acquire the much larger media giant Warner Brothers Discovery, WBD. When I worked in bond research at Salomon Brothers from 1981 to 1984, I often interacted with traders involved in the high-stakes business of risk arbitrage, also known as merger arbitrage. We called these traders ARBs. I've been intrigued by that specialty ever since, further fueled by the evolution of the government's antitrust regulation along the way. In merger arbitrage, the action begins when Company A, the acquirer, bids to take over Company B, the target. This typically occurs at a substantial premium to the target's prevailing stock price. The target's shares jump higher on the news, but not all the way up to the acquirer's bid price. Investors know there's a chance that the deal will get blocked by the antitrust authorities. In such a situation, the target share price would tumble back toward its pre-merger talk level. The ARBs aim to profit from the fluctuations in target stock's price in response to changing perceptions of the probability that the deal will ultimately be consummated. The months-long attempt by Paramount to acquire Warner Brothers highlights several fascinating aspects of merger arbitration. Only a few days ago, the deal looked solidly on track after being waved through by the Department of Justice's, DOJ, Antitrust Division. For a bit of context, this merger entails the $10 billion Paramount Skydance gobbling up the much larger Warner Brothers for $110 billion, making it one of the largest media mergers and the largest all-cash transaction in corporate history. It would combine the legacy film studios with extensive assets like HBO Max and CNN. But 2 days ago, on July 20, the proposed transaction hit a speed bump. U.S. District Judge Araceli Martinez Olguin ordered a 14-day pause on the deal. Shares of WBD dropped nearly 4% and shares of PSKY also declined, falling 2%. The judge's ruling came in response to a lawsuit filed by the Attorneys General, AG, of 12 states, who claimed that further consolidation in the entertainment industry would lead to higher prices for consumers. In antitrust cases, it all comes down to how the relevant market is defined. Objectors to the deal seek to define the market very narrowly, so that the combined companies will appear to have a dominant share of it. If the market is defined more broadly, as the acquirer hopes, more competitors are thrust into the picture, and thus the acquirer appears to have a less dominant share. In that case, the combined company's market share is consequently considered too small to pose any threat of monopolistic pricing. True to form, the state AGs opposing the Paramount Warner deal made the case for a narrow definition. It encompassed only these three categories: wide-release movies, tentpoles — these are big-budget films expected to be blockbusters — and basic cable channels. Under that narrow definition, it was determined that the Paramount-Warner combination would exceed the government's industry concentration limit, as determined by the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, HHI, adopted in 1982. Here's a brief look at HHI. Instead of simply adding up the market shares of the top few firms in an industry, as antitrust enforcers did in earlier times, the HHI totals up the squares of all the competitors. For example, if a highly concentrated industry has five companies with market shares of 30%, 25%, 20%, 15%, and 10%, its HHI is 900, 302, plus 625, plus 400, plus 225, plus 100 equals 2,250. The score ranges from near zero in perfectly competitive markets up to 10,000 in a pure monopoly. The DOJ's Antitrust Division and the Federal Trade Commission determined that if a merger raises the sum of all the squares of the key players in the market by more than 100 points, bringing it to over 1,800, then under present guidelines the deal will probably be ruled anti-competitive and not allowed. But Paramount's management has the right to challenge the A.G.'s definition. No one knows what Paramount's definition is at this point. It didn't bother to file a brief in the A.G.'s lawsuit. After all, the Justice Department gave the acquisition the green light without getting into those details. And President Donald Trump was widely seen as supporting the deal. Paramount CEO David Ellison is the son of Oracle, ORCL, co-founder Larry Ellison, who, it's been widely reported, gave $45 million to a non-profit organization that supported Trump's 2024 election campaign. We'll have to see what argument Paramount's lawyers come up with and how things go in court from this point. In the meantime, consider some interesting fallout from Judge Martinez Olguin's decision, namely, that previously mentioned 4% drop in Paramount's share price. Paramount's shares face a really big downside if the deal dies, due to something that wasn't yet a factor in my early 1980s Salomon Brothers days. Only in the late 1980s did breakup fees become significant in merger and acquisition, M&A, deals, as hostile takeovers became more common with the help of high-yield bond financing. That's something I was in the thick of. If the acquisition doesn't ultimately happen, Paramount will have to pay a $7 billion penalty to Warner Brothers. That's equivalent to 73% of Paramount's current market capitalization. And it's on top of $2.8 billion that Paramount paid to Netflix, NFLX, for terminating its earlier agreement to purchase a big chunk of Warner's operations. Even a delay beyond September 30th in closing the acquisition would whack Paramount's pocketbook to the tune of $650 million a quarter until Warner is finally signed, sealed, and delivered. One last point. I don't want to leave the impression that M&A activity triggers nothing more dramatic than the comparatively modest July 20th moves in Paramount and Warner shares. Look at how shares of both companies move throughout the process. WBD jumped 29% on September 11, 2025. On initial reports that the company was a takeover target, PSKY fell nearly 10% on December 5, 2025, when Warner announced its deal to sell part of itself to Netflix, seemingly knocking Paramount out of the picture. PSKY rebounded by 9% in the very next session as the company made its initial bid for Warner Brothers on February 26, 2026. Warner's board deemed Paramount's bid superior to Netflix's, and PSKY shares rose 10%. The next day, the acquirer and the target signed a definitive agreement and PSKY soared 21%. No wonder those Salomon Brothers ARBs were richly compensated back in the early 1980s. They had a lot of price risk, both up and down, to manage. Martin Fridson, New York. New York. Tell us what you think of today's journal. PorterStansberryDirect@gmail.com, presented by Porter & Company. Three things to know before we go. 1. AI spending continues to rise. Microsoft, MSFT, Alphabet, GOOG, Amazon, AMZN, Meta Platforms, META, and Oracle, ORCL, are now projected to spend $741 billion on data centers and equipment in 2026 to 2.3% of U.S. economic output, versus just 0.3% in 2019. That's an 80% jump from 2025 and $268 billion above the 2026 estimate at the end of last year. The 2027 estimate is now approaching $900 billion. 2. Chasing hot IPOs is not a winning strategy. Shares of Elon Musk's rocket company SpaceX, SpaceX, have fallen 45% from their June 16 peak and now trade below the $135 initial public offering, IPO, price, exactly the outcome we warned about in the June 5 Daily Journal. The bigger test is still ahead. Insiders can start selling 2 trading days after the August 4 earnings report, releasing up to 911.5 million shares, nearly double the 555.6 million sold in the IPO itself. 3. Wall Street's bearish positioning has reached extreme levels. Short interest hit a record 9.0% of shares outstanding across all NYSE-listed stocks in late June, well above the 5.0% peak during the 2008 financial crisis and 6.0% during the 2020 pandemic. History says extreme bearish positioning is rarely rewarded. Shorts are borrowed selling that must eventually become forced buying, and at these levels, any positive catalyst could ignite a squeeze. Chart of the day. Philip Morris International, PM. Philip Morris International, PM, crossed over $11 billion in quarterly sales for the first time ever with its latest Q2 results released today, up 10.4% year-on-year, YI, while earnings per share increased 15% YI to $2.20, both numbers exceeding analyst estimates. The growth was driven by smoke-free products, with sales rising 14% YI to reach a record 42% of total revenue. Shares rallied toward an all-time high and currently trade around $192, for a total return exceeding 140% since our complete investor recommendation in July 2022. Mailbag, you touched a nerve. Patricia F. writes, Why do you believe Hitler, or Himmler, murdered 6 million Jews? Where did that number come from? The 1932 census of Europe was compiled and published in 1933, and it shows that the number of Jews in all the countries that the Germans subsequently occupied was 5,800,000, with the majority in Poland. The next census of Europe happened 10 years after the war. In 1945, there was no counting of who all was imprisoned and who died. We can only rely on German records. But we don't rely on German records. No. No. The Germans intended, we believe, to kill all the Jews, and therefore they are guilty of killing all the Jews, and that would be 6 million. In my opinion, this is an enormous slander of Germany, and it creates a precedent of genocide in the millions, which gives Israel license to do the same. You touched a nerve, Porter. Grant G. writes, "You had me until you said Hitler killed 6 million Jews, which has been completely debunked by many, many people, just not the Jews." Porter comment, "I do not believe there's any rational way to argue that the Nazis did not target all of Europe's Jews and systematically imprison and then murder them. The historical record, including laws, contemporaneous publications, the Nazis' own propaganda, Hitler's own books, and official Nazi records contain a complete account. Likewise, we have the first-hand testimony of dozens of Nazis and other eyewitnesses to these atrocities. In fact, the Nazis' own record-keeping was horrifically precise. They give precise counts for specific operations, like the Hufla telegrams: 1,274,166 Jews killed by the end of 1942 in the four Operation Reinhard camps, Belzec 434,508, Treblinka 713,555, Sobibor 101,370, and Majdanek 24,733. The Korher report confirms that exact total for the general government camps and adds 145,301 for the Warthegau, plus 1,449,692 deported further east. The Einsatzgruppen operational reports tally at least 1,152,731 Jews shot in the occupied Soviet territories by late 1942. Rudolf Haas's sworn affidavit estimates at least 2.5 million gassed and burned at Auschwitz, plus another 500,000 dead from starvation and disease. These figures add up to the roughly 6 million figure presented at Nuremberg. It's hard to believe that anyone would argue this didn't happen. But, sadly, I've seen again and again that people will believe absolutely anything. I often feel like I'm trapped on a prison planet surrounded by the criminally insane. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to Porter & Company. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue.